From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Islamic extremism and the possibility of overthrowing Saddam Hussein with journalist MJ Akbar. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of The Asian Age, an English-language newspaper published in India. Akbar is also the author of the book The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. As a Muslim living in India, Akbar feels threatened by Islamic extremists in Pakistan and Hindu extremists in India. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Lives of the Muses, the new book by Francine Prose. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz says there's no longer any justification for a U.S.-led attack on Iraq. Yesterday, the Baghdad government agreed to the unconditional return of United Nations weapons inspectors. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Kuwait City.
At the opening of a conference in Baghdad, Iraq's deputy prime minister said all excuses for a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq had been eliminated. Tariq Aziz reiterated that Baghdad had agreed to the return of U.N. weapons inspectors as demanded by the U.N. and the U.S. And he said his government was ready to work with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan to implement Iraq's decision. He said that if the arms inspectors acted honestly and professionally, they should reach the truth within a reasonable period of time. But he warned that the Americans might use the inspections as a pretext to attack Iraq. President Saddam Hussein agreed to the return of inspectors after intense diplomatic pressure backed by the threat of U.S. military action. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Kuwait City.
Former Attorney General Janet Reno has conceded defeat in the Florida gubernatorial primary. She congratulated the winner, Bill McBride, and said that she'll support him in his campaign against the Republican incumbent, Governor Jeb Bush. McBride won by less than 5,000 votes out of more than 1.3 million cast. Reno, whose own vote was delayed by equipment and training problems at her polling place, said she'll also campaign for election reform. Recounts in Miami-Dade and Broward counties turned up more than 3,000 uncounted votes for Reno. Congressional investigators say the U.S. government may not have done everything it could to prevent the September 11th attacks. They'll present the findings from their lengthy investigation tomorrow. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Congressional investigators say they've interviewed close to 500 witnesses and examined hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. A congressional source says that investigators found many clues in the intelligence files from before September 11 of last year. Intelligence and law enforcement officials had obtained information about possible attacks, not just overseas, but also within the U.S. They also had information indicating that terrorists might use airplanes as weapons. Investigators are asking if intelligence analysts could have done more with that information and whether the White House could have put the government and the public on a higher state of alert. The record shows no sign that the U.S. could have predicted the exact time and place of the strike, but investigators are asking if the U.S. could have taken more precautions. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 173 points, or 2%, to close at 8,207 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 16 points to close at 1,259. This is NPR News. A blue-ribbon panel of business leaders is calling for big changes in the way corporations pay executives. They say huge disparities in pay are undermining investor faith in the markets. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The panel was put together by the Conference Board in the wake of the recent accounting scandals and includes Vanguard founder John Bogle, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, and famed investor Warren Buffett. A report issued by the commission says too many executives get lavish pay packages even when the companies they head fail. Intel Chairman Andy Grove says many corporate boards need to reassert control over the executives who work for them.
We should put our efforts to solving the real problem, which is reinstituting a constitutional democracy in our corporations in place of the fiefdoms many have become.
The commission said board compensation committees should be more independent and should look for ways to tie executive pay to long-term performance. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
NBA All-Star Patrick Ewing is retiring after 17 years in professional basketball. He told a news conference in New York that it's time to move on.
It was a hard decision to make because I still feel that, you know, I can still play. But I just felt that it was time for me to go on with the next chapter in my life. So my decision is to retire.
Ewing, who's now 40, spent 15 years with the New York Knicks. He was chosen one of the 50 best players in the history of the National Basketball Association. The All-Star Center finished his career with more than 24,000 points and nearly 12,000 rebounds. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 17 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at Aveda.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, MJ Akbar, has been observing the war on terrorism and the possibility of war with Iraq from his perspective as a journalist in India. Akbar is one of India's foremost journalists. He's written for The Times of India, launched India's weekly news magazine, Sunday, and is now the founding editor of The Asian Age, an English-language newspaper which is published in India and London. He's the author of books about India and Kashmir. His latest book is called The Shade of Swords, Jihad, and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. The last few chapters focus on recent history and try to explain how Pakistan became a breeding ground for terrorists. As a Muslim living in India, Akbar is faced with Muslim extremists across the border in Pakistan and Hindu extremists within India. I spoke with him yesterday morning and asked first where the Indian government stands on the possibility of war with Iraq.
Well, the official Indian government point of view is hampered by the history of India-Iraq relations, which have, as is now reasonably well known, has been consistent and very good. And Iraq has taken positions which have been the Indian positions on difficult issues like Kashmir and so on. So there is a history of accord which might not be very attractive to Washington. But I think it's also very clear that India's prime concern at the moment is not amity with Iraq. India's major concern is both the regional, local, as well as the international fight against terror. Because more than any other country, India has been affected by this evil of terrorism consistently. It has bled India substantially. We have been actually talking about this long, long before I think this subject came up on the kind of radar map of Washington or America to the extent that it has done now. I mean, our 9/11s happened many times and over the last 15 years, 20 years.
So India would support the United States in a war against Iraq?
India may not be too explicit about it because of regional considerations, but I really have no doubt that if the case against Saddam as a supporter of terrorism was made, then India would be in the forefront of the support.
What kind of case do you think India would be looking for? I mean, what evidence is enough evidence?
The evidence linking him to Al-Qaeda, for instance. I mean, the international community, whether India or France or Europe, would want to see that. Evidence linking him to any specific event, to 9/11, where Iraqi agents actually in touch with Mohammed Atta. I mean, has the CIA found credible evidence for that? Yes, and I think if that evidence is placed on the table, sure. Are there really weapons of mass murder that are being made against in violation of UN resolutions? So these questions are there, and the world is not ready to accept a single viewpoint, but the world would actually like evidence. And this much I can say, and I say this now personally because I've been to Iraq so many years ago, and the dictatorship of Saddam is a tyranny. You know, I must add that the fight against Taliban and the writing against Taliban, my real problem with the Taliban long before 9/11 was the barbarism that they inflicted upon their own people, upon the women in particular. And, you know, all through those years, when Pakistan was supporting the Taliban, Washington did very little. In fact, the oil companies, etc., were negotiating with the Taliban all the time, you know, to get their deals together. And some of us who have watched all this happening are relieved that censors sort of dawned or appeared, but can't quite forget the years of negligence, which we might even call years of betrayal.
So are you suggesting you think the United States might have an ulterior motive now, as it did in negotiating with the Taliban in previous years?
I don't think any country does anything without an ulterior motive. The point is that you have to sell that ulterior motive in order to build the alliance. And if that is done, good.
What do you think the ulterior motive might be in this case?
Well, I think, you know, one ulterior motive might be the simple fact that you have not been able to be as successful in the war against terrorism in South Asia, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as you wanted to be. A year ago, it was Osama dead or alive. Today, it's Osama who knows where. And, you know, given the fight, I was in Kandahar 3 weeks ago, if you have a minute. And one of the more remarkable things I saw, it was truly impressive, believe me, as a journalist who has covered a great deal of war and heaven knows violence. But the precision bombing that the Americans did in Kandahar was, and, you know, they bombed Kandahar for 6 weeks during the war. The precision bombing and the quality of military technology was awesome because you could actually see just apartments taken out and the rest of the house virtually standing and, you know, buildings next door untouched. So the kind of technology that America possesses is absolutely awesome. And it's certainly many, many generations ahead of what we saw in the Gulf War. Despite such technological mastery, the fact that, you know, the Taliban wasn't a certain individual. The Taliban was 20, 30,000 people. They were administration. It was a party. It was a whole movement. So my point is that, you know, this war against terrorism is not simply a war of weapons and arms. It's also a war in the mind.
When you say a war in the mind, you mean that this war, that the war of terrorists isn't dependent on having a terrorist government or one country in which all the terrorists can gather in. It's a way of thinking that can continue in spite of the overthrowing of a terrorist government.
You know, if this had been television, you'd have seen me nodding my head, you know, with great vigor as you said all that. You're absolutely right. It is that. And the breeding ground for the next generation of terrorists lies not only in the actions that happen today, but also in what is the intellectual or what is the emotional washback that appears in, you know, with each event.
If you're just joining us, my guest is MJ Akbar. He's the author of the new book, The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of The Asian Age, which is a newspaper, an English-language newspaper published in India that's also circulated in London. It has a circulation of about 200,000. I'm wondering if the United States does attack Iraq, what is the direct impact you think it might have on your life and on your country?
Well, I think we probably need to redefine this. Is the United States going to attack Iraq, or is it going to attack Saddam Hussein? Mm-hmm. Is it a regime change, or is it a war against a nation? And I think within the difference of these two perspectives, you might probably begin to find the answers. A regime change would probably be far more acceptable, even among those who would squirm at the morality of the idea. You know, I mean, you can't really run the world by saying that, you know, I don't agree with this guy and he has to go out. I mean, it's really not the concern of a power or a superpower to go around passing judgment on this run. But given the track record of a particular individual, right, many people who might in principle disagree with the United States would probably look the other way and say, well, you know, the United States is doing a dirty but probably necessary job. Let's get on with the rest of life. If this is converted into a war against Iraq, then the story becomes very different. And, you know, I mean, the United States I saw in Kandahar American troops in little garrisons at the Kandahar airport protecting themselves, not moving out, really barracked away. Do you want barracks like that across the whole region from Iraq right up to Kazakhstan? I mean, you're not, I I dread the fact that you might be stepping into your 21st century Vietnam. And you've got to think about this extremely seriously before, you know, before rhetoric or oratory or just, you know, selfish corporate interest begins to make every policy. I think Americans must really think about this quite seriously.
Are there risks in the region that you think are important to discuss? Risks,
yes,
if we do try to overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Yes, I think, let me go back, if I may, to Afghanistan. What my great worry is at the moment, that the whole Taliban movement, which was in such bad odor a year ago, after the Bamiyan Buddha's destruction, an evil deed, if anything, you know, and really would besmirch the reputation of Muslims and Islam more than anything else that I can think of. I might tell you that all the Muslim countries in the region, when they heard that the Bamiyan Buddhas, including Iran, were being going to be destroyed, rushed in and pleaded with the Taliban that they would actually take these Buddhas up and keep them in storage, you know, waiting for this nonsense called Taliban to go away. But it was destroyed. Now, if today, memory among people is the most vulnerable fact of life, you know, suddenly a roseate glow begins to appear over the same person who a year ago was barbarian. And if the Taliban begin to represent the nationalism of Afghanistan, if they begin to represent that, then we have got serious worries ahead. We really have serious worries ahead because you don't know where the war. This is a war against irregular armies. This is a war against shadow armies. This is not a war against uniforms. And so we have to be extremely careful. Iraq is a country with a strong, you know, sense of national independence. And if that is by any chance, but Saddam's whole philosophy, whole policy is to equate himself, make himself synonymous with Iraqi nationalism. And, you know, if that is disturbed or touched, we are walking into a hornet's nest of very serious proportions.
What do you mean? What are the hornets that might rise up?
The hornets would be the hornets of revenge. The hornets would be the hornets who would fly across little corners across the world. And you do remember a superpower, by definition, is a power that does not exist, that does not live only at home. If you want to conquer the world, you have to live in the whole world. So American interests actually exist in Pakistan. The presence exists. And the American presence is, it has an economic form, it has a political form, it has a diplomatic form. And everything suddenly across a huge region becomes vulnerable to people who suddenly equate America with injustice. And that, if that happens, we're looking at a very long story ahead.
My guest is Indian journalist M.J. Akbar. He's the author of The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, M.J. Akbar, is one of India's leading journalists. He's the founding editor of the English-language newspaper The Asian Age and the author of the book The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. The Senate Majority Leader, Tom Daschle, has asked a lot of questions about this possible regime change in Iraq. He said, if we strike Iraq preemptively, does that set a precedent for India to preemptively strike Pakistan? What do you think of this question? What did you think about when you heard it?
I think he has actually raised a very relevant issue. India's nuclear doctrine is very clear, no first strike. On the other hand, against a first strike, almost total annihilation would be the response. I dread that day. And you know, I think, Terry, that last summer in May, we came as close as any area in the world has ever come to a nuclear confrontation. I am a normal human being, I promise you. It terrified the hell out of me. And I'm also an Indian. I was taking a flight from London to Delhi on the day the advisory went out. And I know that day was particularly sensitive and decisions were in the making. And the attendant at Virgin Airlines at London Airport was the first time I've heard an airline say that they not only want to give me back the ticket, but would be happy to accommodate me later. You know, the only answer I could give her, I'm sorry, I don't know if you're going to nuclear war or not, but I'm going home because there is no other place for me. Those of us who have to live in India and want to live in India and indeed dream that our children come back to India don't want an India and Pakistan living under a nuclear shadow. Nobody wants it. But the answer is not in good intentions. Good intentions are simply not good enough. The answer lies in some principled polity being applied into that subcontinent. The nuclear game is simply too dangerous to be left to generals. And I really hope that the world understands that.
How worried are you now that there will be a nuclear war between India and Pakistan?
Well, you know, I know Indian and Indians and Pakistanis are mad, but I don't believe they are completely insane. You know, I've been dealing with the Kashmir problem both in an individual capacity and as a journalist, you know, in some form or the other. And I was talking to one of the extreme groups called the Hurriyat, known to be pro-Pakistani, known to support violence in the past. And we had this dialogue on the basis that violence and terrorism was no longer acceptable as strategy or as it was a complete no-no. Now, after we had agreed on that, then we talked. And I told these nice people, I mean, they just represented an anti-Indian group, and we were a citizens' committee. And I told them, look, the simplest solution to the Kashmir problem is nuclear war. Nuclear war, no Kashmir, no problem. Do you want that? Or do we need to now start walking on a bridge, or walking on a two-way street, as I do use this phrase, nothing really walks on a one-way street. Can't we get on a two-way street and begin an effort that stops what would be a huge and horrible world calamity? Think of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. Do you think that we have all the sophistication to limit our war only to India and Pakistan? The whole of the oil region, the whole of West Asia, the whole of Central Asia, with its huge resources, I mean, that's what the real international fight is about, isn't it? National resources. All of it is heading for contamination. All of it is heading towards a region where no sane person will actually want to enter. You're going to have a world catastrophe, not just a South Asia catastrophe. And I hope the world, and America in particular, since it is the preeminent power of the world, wakes up to the damage that India and Pakistan could do.
Now, do you think America's war against terrorism is helping to eliminate some of the threat over nuclear confrontation over Kashmir? Or do you think that it's intensifying the conflict between India and Pakistan?
What is the one thing that comes in the way of a dialogue between India and Pakistan? One thing, just one thing, cross-border terrorism. That has been an issue with Delhi. That has been an issue with India. We say, and I'm glad that we say it, and I hope America understands, that if Pakistan does not stop this covert support to terrorists, this is a non-negotiable. Terrorism is non-negotiable. Now, if America can lean sufficiently strongly upon Pakistan to stop this, we could have the beginnings of a dialogue and we could have the making of some form of peace, or at least a non-war situation, absolutely, immediately. You could have it this winter. You don't have to go further than that.
MJ Akbar is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of The Asian Age, which is an English-language newspaper based in India that also has a circulation in England. Yeah. Pakistan is one of America's allies in the war against terrorism. On the other hand, Pakistan has been a place where a lot of terrorists have sought shelter. One of the members of Al-Qaeda was just arrested in Karachi. Pakistan has a lot of extremist Muslims who are fighting India over Kashmir. Are you kind of confused now about where Pakistan stands on the issue of terrorism and where Musharraf stands?
Well, one of the... I must here refer to Janus, We all know the relationship we have to Greek mythology, the two faces of Janus, one looking towards west, one looking towards east. Pakistan's position is something like that. To the west, it is an important ally in the fight against terror, but towards the east, it puts on a different face. But one of the major themes of, one of the major questions that my book seeks to answer is, why are American troops today in Pakistan and Afghanistan? I mean, why has Pakistan become the haven and the breeding ground of the largest number of terrorists that you see emanating? And I'm quite surprised, actually, at the lack of interest or the lack of connectivity that exists in America. Not enough people want to ask this, maybe because Pakistan is seen as a friend and you don't want to actually besmirch the reputation of a friend. But leave emotions aside. The simple fact is that it's not just 9/11. You know, Americans have forgotten that the World Trade Center was attacked before. The World Trade Center was attacked, years ago. And during the trial of the attack, the person who was in charge, I forget his name, and I don't want to take a wrong name, it would be wrong and insensitive of me if I made a mistake. So the person I remember clearly, and I mentioned it in my book, he dreamt of these towers toppling and promised that they would happen again. And there was no follow-up. Each time, whether the terrorist is Yemeni, whether the terrorist is from any other country, all the leads and the connectivities enter into some labyrinth in Pakistan.
MJ Akbar is the author of The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. He's also the founding editor-in-chief of The Asian Age, an English-language newspaper published in India. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The New Rabbi, A Congregation Searches for Its Leader by Stephen Fried. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, life as a Muslim in India. We continue our conversation with journalist MJ Akbar, editor-in-chief of the newspaper The Asian Age, published in India. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Lives of the Muses by Francine Prose.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with MJ Akbar, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Asian Age, an English-language newspaper published in India. Akbar has written several books about India. His latest book is called The Shade of Swords, Jihad, and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. The last few chapters tried to explain how Pakistan, which was created to protect Islam, quickly politicized jihad and became a breeding ground for extremists. As you point out in your book, The Shade of Swords, Pakistan should have become a model Muslim state.
Right.
What were the hopes for Pakistan when it was created in 1947?
I think the hopes were actually tremendous because it was, it was a nation without a history. It was a nation without a past and therefore implicitly a nation with a future. In some senses, it was like America, when it was created and when it got independence. Everything, every potential was there to make it into a modern nation, particularly when in the sort of breakup of the Ottoman Empire, no Muslim nation, because of reasons which are complex, I don't know how many of those reasons will find expression in our conversation now, but many of those reasons, I deal with in some seriousness, because in the no Muslim nation has been able to create a modern polity. There is no democracy, or if there is democracy, it's a kind of stuttering occasional democracy that you see in Indonesia or now in Bangladesh. No Muslim nation has been able to provide. It's one of the great paradoxes that the only Muslims who have enjoyed consistent and sustained democracy over the last 50 years have been Indian Muslims. Now, this doesn't mean that they don't have any problems. I come from a state where I have to fight against the carnage in Gujarat, against the evil of, a state government using lynch mob violence against my community. But I will deal with it. It's my country and I will deal with its problems. But I'm equally proud to say that Indian Muslims are the only ones who have experienced sustained democracy. Why have the other Muslim nations not been able to become the governments no longer represent or do not ever have represented the street? And within that tension lies so many of the problems of the state. Pakistan could have been a democracy. Pakistan could have, but the elite that seized power in Pakistan was not willing to accept land reform, was not willing to accept the kind of... It had inherited real estate. You see a situation in Saudi Arabia where a government and a family has inherited a country. It's amazing. Have you ever heard of anyone with the audacity to rename a nation? This country was Arabia. This is the country of the Prophet. The Prophet Muhammad never, renamed this country Muhammadiyah Arabia. How can the Saud family turn around one day and say it's Saudi Arabia and all the world sits back and applauds and you feel as if a decision of such consequence will have no reaction? It may not have an immediate reaction, but history is not made up of, this moment in time. History is the next five generations.
Well, let's focus on Pakistan. Pakistan, as you say, should have become a model Muslim state. It didn't. Is there any, one particular point you could point to in Pakistan's history and say, this is where it started to go wrong?
Yeah, it started to go wrong with the adoption of the first constitution, which, by the way, was done by the law minister at that time, was Brohi, and which was a model constitution, a great constitution. I think this was in 1955 or 56. Within a year of that constitution being adopted, the military turned up and completely abrogated the constitution and seized power in the name, as usual, of patriotism and national interest or whichever little bit of garbage turns up in their lexicon all the time. After this next swivel moment in Pakistan's history came during Zia because, a question at the heart of a nation, at the heart of every nation, is why was this country created? Now, if you say that this country was created as a shelter, as a rehabilitation center, as a homeland for the South Asia's Muslims, good, fine. But you cannot stop short on that road of logic. If you've got to create a homeland, then you've got to create a homeland for all the Muslims. The idea of Pakistan was not strong enough to sustain itself. In 1971, it broke apart. But came the next point, if I may continue. The next point was that Pakistan was created in order to protect Islam. Not to protect people, Muslims, but to protect Islam. Now, that took you into another dimension, because if Islam was in danger, that is an absurd concept, because no religion can ever be in danger. Religion is a powerful fact beyond human beings. But if Islam was going to be created in danger, then obviously the government of Pakistan had to become Islamic. And within the logic of this, which Zia introduced to Pakistan, came the state within the state and the conflict between the two states.
You are an Indian Muslim.
Yes, indeed I am.
Why did your family stay in India and not try to move to Pakistan after the partition, when Pakistan was created as a Muslim state in 1947?
Well, it's a complete fallacy to believe that every Indian Muslim wanted to go to Pakistan. Lots of Indian Muslims did not want to leave their cultural inheritance. My father was a refugee in 47. I wasn't born. I was born in 51. And he went to Pakistan as a refugee. He went to Dhaka because we were living in Calcutta. And he came back in 3 months. He came back to his devastated home, to his small town. And, when I was growing up, I remember this very clearly. My father was of Victorian kind of temperament, so he didn't particularly have any sense of humor in the way we understand it. And we didn't have much conversation either. I wasn't yapping with him all the time. It was far more formal, if you remember the 60s or the 50s. And I once asked him, as I was growing up, is why did he come back from Pakistan? And his answer remains completely sort of, part of my memory. He said there were too many Muslims in Pakistan.
What did he mean by that?
Yes, exactly. He meant he missed the variety of India. He missed the cultural variety. He missed the fact that he had friends who were Hindus and friends who were Sikhs. And he missed his inheritance of music and his inheritance of, playing cards with a disparate group of friends and all the things that you do in a small town.
Now, what are some of the things that you can do as a Muslim in India that you wouldn't be able to do as a Muslim in Pakistan?
Well, I certainly wouldn't be able to vote freely if I was a Muslim in Pakistan to begin with. I wouldn't be able to have a drink, I'm afraid to say, as I do as a Muslim in India. Now, I know that many people are going to get hostile to this answer, but I'm afraid, as a believing Muslim, and I'm a believer, I also believe that Allah is merciful. And if Allah is merciful, then I have to give him some reason to be merciful towards me later on. But not being facetious, I'm merely trying to say that, that what we do have in India is the right to be free. And that right to be free is not merely a political right. It is a social right. It is perhaps the right to make mistakes. But it is the right to tell a clergy that it cannot control my relationship with my God, that they cannot be my interlocutors. It is the right to tell the clergy that they are not the state. They are part of my, religious practice. They are not the state.
What are you up against as a Muslim in India?
I'm against Hindu fundamentalism. That is the biggest problem that I face. And in part, that Hindu fundamentalism and its desire to convert India into Hindu state has been fed by the fact that Muslims in Pakistan have moved away towards a kind of fundamentalism. I tell you, much against the wishes of the majority of the Pakistani people. I go to Pakistan. No, they don't want a fundamentalist state. But this action and reaction is an intricate interplay. And the rise of Hindu fundamentalism and its, abhorrent manifestation in riots like the one we saw in Gujarat is really the biggest problem. But then, we are a democracy, and we will fight this. We will fight this. We will fight the Ku Klux Klans of India. Of course we will.
So you see the rise of Hindu fundamentalism in India as being a response to the rise of Islamic fundamentalism?
In part, yes. I must be objective and fair and say that.
But only in part?
Only in part, because, there is nothing which justifies the rise of any fundamentalism. An excuse is not an answer.
My guest is Indian journalist M.J. Akbar. He's the author of The Shade of Swords, Jihad, and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. MJ Akbar is my guest. He's a journalist who's based in India. He's the editor-in-chief and founder of The Asian Age, which is an English-language newspaper that's also circulated in England. And he's been a journalist all of his life, except for a couple of years when he was in government. His new book is called The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. Now, when you ask the meaning of jihad, a lot of Muslims will tell you that the main meaning of jihad is about the battle within, the battle for purity within. You say that that the other meaning of jihad, the meaning of actual war and fighting, is being underplayed here. Make your case about that.
Yes, you know, it's become politically correct. Now, let me tell you the story behind this. The Prophet was actually returning from a jihad. And as he was entering the city, he told his followers that don't rejoice in the military victory. The greater jihad is cleansing yourself from within, is making the fight against your own injustice, your own problems. And as a concept and as a philosophy, that is one of the most powerful facts of the Islamic creed. Nobody denies that. But equally, you cannot deny the role of jihad in Islamic history. It is absurd to deny that role. And I think, some of the denial comes out of a new defensiveness, which has come about among Muslims. They don't want to be associated with just their history because they are terrified of even their past success, even as they secretly savor it. The jihad is not as simple. The opening sentences of my book perhaps would indicate this. The Shade of Swords is from a saying of the Prophet, the title. And the full sentence is, paradise is under a shade of swords. Now, as an image, it's marvelous. I mean, it's almost like a marriage where you walk under a shade of flowers to the altar, except that you walk under the shade of swords. But to which purpose? Now, that's the question. And therefore, the opening sentences of the book, the shade of swords is not an invitation to kill. It is an invitation to die. And here comes the spirit of martyrdom, which is such an important element in the Muslim mentality when it comes to war. Give everything else, and what could be bigger than life, in the service of a higher cause. And then comes the bargain which Allah has made with the believer and with the martyr. Paradise is not promised to those who have won a jihad. Paradise is indeed promised to those who have become martyrs in a jihad. And, you know, this is a significant point which will perhaps begin to explain to you why so many young children who feel that, you know, for right or wrong, who feel that they have been victims of injustice, are ready to walk with bombs strapped around their bodies.
As a Muslim, how strongly do you feel you need to speak out against the extremist brand of Islam that is behind today's terrorism?
I think it is the bounden duty. It's an archaic phrase, but I repeat it. It is the bounden duty of every Muslim to speak out against Muslim fundamentalism, just as it is the bounden duty of every Christian to speak out against Christian fundamentalism, and every Hindu to speak out against Hindu fundamentalism. We must confront the ogres within our own selves. It is no point, it doesn't make very much sense for a Christian to come and preach to Muslims that you must stop fundamentalism. No, preach unto thyself. I mean, look at yourself. And only Muslims can eradicate Muslim fundamentalism. Others can't. It's a given. And therefore, we must mobilize fully and totally and without any either confusion or deception in this fight.
Do you think Muslims are doing enough to mobilize against extremist fundamentalism and terrorism?
Enough is a difficult word to quantify. But I do know, I want to repeat the instance of Imam Ghazali. Imam Ghazali, one of the great lawgivers of Islam, and he was at the time of the assassins. And he gave a fatwa. He said, if Muslims do not stop terrorism, in the end, they will not destroy the enemy. Long before they destroy the enemy, they will destroy themselves. And this is the message that has to be sent across to them. Use Imam Ghazali. Use your own lawgivers. Use your own solons. And go to the texts, and you will find the answers. Because this experience is not the first experience in Islamic history of this phenomenon. Go into the past to rescue the future.
A lot of people, particularly after September 11th, really turned toward religion for some sense of comfort and understanding. But I think some other people felt that religion has been responsible for firing up so many wars. Does the extremist end of Islam make you feel does it make you feel alienated from your own religion, or do you feel more that it's your job to kind of reclaim the religion away from the extremists?
Let me just put it this way. Islam would not have lasted for 1,400 years and become a world religion if all it had advocated was violence. No idea sustains itself with violence. The meaning of Islam is peace. It's salam. It's peace. It was created as a force of peace. All that it did was that it recognized the reality of war in human affairs. It would not shy away from that reality. Did the church ever shy away from recognizing the reality of war in human affairs? No, you cannot. But once it recognized the reality, it also circumscribed it. Not many people know that the jihad, that there are 10 rules of jihad, which were defined by Abu Bakr and Hazrat Umar, the first two caliphs who were very successful. Among that, it is specifically forbidden to kill women and children. It is specifically forbidden to hit any innocents or to kill any innocents or to wound any innocents. It is forbidden to actually destroy a palm tree. You cannot destroy crops. When the armies of Saladin and before him, Saladin is famous, everybody knows him, so I use the analogy. When they walked, they would walk in the defile between, you know, cultivated lands so that not a single blade of grass was activated. All right, maybe that was too high and idealistic a time and not everyone can be expected. But this is no. I mean, terrorism is not jihad. For God's sake, it is not. You should not demean the concept of jihad, and you should not demean Islam by confusing terrorism with jihad.
Well, we're about out of time, but I have one last question for you. You spent 2 years in government from 89 to 91. You were a spokesperson for the Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi. You were in Parliament for a couple of years. Apparently, you didn't like it very much. You didn't stay in government very long.
I think they didn't like me very much either.
You were a journalist long before you entered government, and you've been a journalist ever since. What didn't you like about serving in government?
Well, you know, to begin with, your thin has to be far thicker than mine was. Your skin, I mean. You know, politics is the art of, you know, using a stiletto and a knife at the back when it comes to real politics. Number two, in our system as it was at that time, it was very difficult. I think things have changed a bit. It was very difficult for a professional who had no, you know, independent means of income to remain honest as well as in public life. And I was not used to sort of indulging in the one. As a journalist, one had a few morals, not too many of them, but one had a few and a bit of a conscience. And the mismatch was too much for me. I had to get back into an honest job. Or as honest a job as journalism is.
And has your experience in government changed the way you perceive government when you cover it?
I think it has. And in the positive sense, because I understand that government is not as easy a job as we sometimes from the outside make it out to be. I think service in public life is also an extremely difficult business. It requires a tremendous amount of commitment. You know, you don't want to be woken up at 6 in the morning where somebody's saying that the taps don't run, but you have to, you know. And it's very difficult. It's a difficult life. Yeah, some of the rewards are glamorous, but, you know, the hard work is there. Still, and, you know, you realize very quickly that when you're not made for each other, you have to find a divorce settlement.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful talking to you. And, you know, no conversation is a one-way street either. And thank you.
MJ Akbar is the author of The Shade of Swords, Jihad and the Conflict Between Islam and Christianity. He's also the founding editor-in-chief of The Asian Age, an English-language newspaper published in India. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Lives of the Muses, a new book by Francine Prose profiling women who inspired the work of male artists. This is Fresh Air. In her first book of nonfiction, The Lives of the Muses, critic and novelist Francine Prose examines the fate of 9 women who throughout modern history inspired famous artists. But critic Maureen Corrigan says musedom sometimes sounds exciting here, but she's glad that feminism opened up other career options for artistically inclined women.
Francine Prose's new book, The Lives of the Muses, is almost too much fun to read. After all, a book that deliciously dwells on Dr. Samuel Johnson's bondage fantasies, the pre-Raphaelite artist Dante Gabriel Rossetti's necrophilia, and Salvador Dali's fondness for decorating himself with human excrement, comes dangerously close to sounding like an extended version of one of those dish-the-dirt biographical exposés in Vanity Fair. But Francine Prose is no mere high-toned gossip monger. An insightful and inventive critic, as well as an entertaining one, Prose takes her historical exploration of the role of muse seriously. If a little mud gets slung, well, it's all in the name of scholarship. Because the career of muse, especially after the advent of feminism, has fallen into disrepute, Prose recognizes that she's got to first convince her contemporary readers of the potential dignity and power of that role. So she tells us a fascinating opening anecdote. In the spring of 1932, Columbia University invited an 80-year-old Englishwoman to New York in order to confer an honorary doctorate upon her. The elderly woman was Alice Pleasance Liddell Hargreaves, the originating cause of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. Alice's honorary doctorate in musedom, Prose says, is very possibly the only one in academic history. The flair for the dramatic that Prose displays in telling this story extends to her rollicking discussions of the lives and work of other muses. There's Hester Thrale, the great lady who entertained Dr. Johnson as her house guest for 16 years, and who, after his death, published anecdotes and a volume of his letters to her. Consequently, Prose says that Thrale was the first muse to discover that a decent living could be made, a more or less respectable literary reputation earned, by mining her relationship with her artist. There are victim muses like Lizzie Siddle, the copper-haired working-class model for so many of Rossetti's paintings, whose suicide by overdose of laudanum was provoked by Rossetti's flagrant infidelities. After Lizzie's death, the shameless Rossetti took up spiritualism, summoning up the ghostly Lizzie to rap on tables and give her opinion of his current paintings. Also flitting around in this broad category is Caris Weston, photographer Edward Weston's model, who, like Lizzie, degenerated into an art wife, exchanging her lyre and flute, Prose says, for the diaper and dish rag. Prose christens Lou Andreas Salome a serial muse because she inspired, in turn, Nietzsche, Rilke, and Freud, who himself paid homage to Andreas Salome by calling her the great understander. The possibility of collaborative musedom is suggested by the odd symbiotic partnership of George Balanchine and Suzanne Farrell. And then there are those muses who are determined to play second fiddle to no man. Gala Dali is in this group. So is Yoko Ono, the most reviled muse of our time. Prose acknowledges that Yoko's harsh reception as an artist in her own right owed much to race and gender prejudice. Yet she refuses to second John Lennon's estimation of Yoko as a genius. The insistence on being noticed, Prose shrewdly observes, makes so much of her art seem more coy than profound. The Lives of the Muses doesn't offer startlingly new biographical information on these women and their artists. Instead, its strength lies in Prose's skill as a gifted synthesizer and interpreter of familiar facts. As such, she stretches her readers' appreciation of the different forms of heterosexual love, which certainly manifests itself in all shapes, sizes, and neurotic variations throughout these life stories. Reflecting on the glaring absence here of male muses, Prose says that female artists seem less inclined to idealize their male companions. In lieu of muses, they're more often given male psychiatric nurses, like Leonard Wolfe. Of course, men historically have been less willing to act as passive enablers of women's art, the traditional muse's role that Prose questions throughout her book. Being a muse, she suggests, may oftentimes be a dirty, thankless job, but somebody's got to do it. Or do they?
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Lives of the Muses by Francine Prose. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. helped create Saddam Hussein. We talk with journalist Christopher Dickey about his cover story for the current edition of Newsweek. We'll also discuss what the future might look like if the U.S. did overthrow Saddam Hussein. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.